This week on Making Contact,
I just couldn't believe that the government and the society could just let the children stay in the situation being exposed to high dose of radiation every day.
Women are gaining influence as leaders throughout the world, fighting for peace, justice, the environment, and civil society. In this program, we profile three anti-nuclear activists working to stop both nuclear weapons and energy. Japan's Kaori Izumi leads her country's grassroots response to the Fukushima disaster. Winona LaDuke is a legendary Native American anti-nuclear activist. And from the U.S., Alice Slater heads a global campaign to ban nuclear weapons. I'm Sandina Robbins, your host this week on Making Contact. This program is produced by the Women Rising Radio Project. Kaori Izumi grew up in Sapporo, Japan, an independent thinker who felt stifled by Japanese social attitudes towards women.
I was a very active girl, ambitious, and wanted freedom always. As a student, I studied sociology, and I was so bored at the university, and Japanese society was so frustrating. So I wanted to get out. So I took 1 year off and traveled to Africa. And then I decided to work on the development issues in Africa. I did my master, and I got a job in Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, working on women and development in rural areas. I got married to a Norwegian. I moved to Norway. I got my family, and I got my PhD during that time. And I came back to Japan. But then this 3/11, the Fukushima accident happened. Immediately after 3/11, I set up my own group called Chateau Tomari. Tomari is the name of the nuclear power plant in Hokkaido, where I live. And that's how I started. Fukushima disaster was the reason why I got involved. I understood that we Japanese, our lives are in the hands of these people who don't know about the situation and who don't know how to handle it. You know, I really felt so scared. I was waiting for somebody to go onto the street and called for demonstration. And then in the end, I decided to do it. And the first one, I think 250 came. We did everything we could do. Court case, petitions, demonstrations, sit-in, negotiations, everything I could think of.
After the Fukushima disaster, Kaori Izumi's Shut Tomari movement forced the shutdown of the Tomari nuclear power plant in Hokkaido. She also organized women's protests in front of Japan's parliament and led demonstrations with hundreds of thousands in Tokyo, demanding the shutdown of all nuclear power plants in Japan. And they won. Japan's Prime Minister Noda closed all Japan's power plants, yet the light stayed on using increased efficiency and a little conservation. So why did Noda allow the Ohi power plant to restart when hundreds of thousands of Japanese citizens marched to demand that it remain closed? Kaori Izumi points to Japan's nuclear relationship with the United States.
Prime Minister Noda went to New York to meet Obama. And we initiated a petition on Fukushima Unit 4. That Fukushima Unit 4 is a threat to the international security. And UN should call for a world summit and call all the international knowledge and expertise to help Japan to stabilize Fukushima 4. We sent a letter to Noda and to Ban Ki-moon. But I understood only later that what they discussed between Obama and Noda was not to how to stabilize Fukushima 4, but how the two countries should work together to promote safer nuclear power. Japan would stop nuclear power policy, I mean to change, you know, to put an end to nuclear power. And for U.S., it's so important to keep Japan as a partner of nuclear arms and the power.
President Obama went much farther than simply pressuring Japan to recommit to nuclear power. In fact, not too long after the Fukushima disaster in 2011, Obama committed billions of dollars in loan guarantees to enable the building of new nuclear power plants in the U.S. Those power plants will be built by none other than General Electric and the Tokyo Electric Power Company, known as TEPCO. GE and TEPCO are the same companies that brought us Fukushima.
TEPCO, this is, I think, the worst nuclear mafia dictator. They have no sense of, I think, feelings or empathy or responsibility. What they think is money. And because they are now bankrupt, the only solution for them is to restart oil. Our government, they haven't learned from Fukushima. They ignored all the warnings from experts. They manipulated data. They say that it's safe, and they will take the responsibility when they are not taking any responsibility on Fukushima. TEPCO is the first-class criminal, killing so many people and going to kill so many people for generations, not only in Japan. And they have free hand to go anywhere in the world and to make the same crime paid by the United States president. This is a crime, I think. The U.S., the government, and the people should learn from Fukushima. That's the only way how, you know, people in Fukushima could recover from this disaster. If nobody learns from this disaster, their suffering becomes just a waste. Please, we should be the last one to have this suffering. And only when Fukushima becomes a lesson that people learn, and close down all the nuclear power plants in the world. That's why people also could get back Fukushima. Fukushima means land of happiness.
Winona LaDuke is a leader from the Ojibwe Nation in Minnesota. She grew up in two cultures, becoming well known in both for her visionary social and political activism. Winona was Ralph Nader's running mate on the Green Party presidential ticket in 2000. She's been an anti-nuclear activist and a major force in the struggle for environmental justice since she was a teenager.
I've been working on issues around nuclear power since I was about 18. And that's a good chunk of my life, pretty much all of it. And I remember reading this article in Rolling Stone magazine that was about Navajo uranium miners being sent underground to work in uranium mines for Kerr McGee under a Department of Labor program. $1.64 an hour, no ventilation, drinking water from the bottom of the mines. So I started doing this, looking at what was going on down there. And in the early mid-70s, or by mid-75, 76, there was 44 operating uranium mines and 10 uranium mills, 5 coal-fired power plants and 4 coal strip mines. A lot of Navajos were employed, and a lot of Navajo water was by that time getting contaminated. And the irony, which is still an irony, is that while the Navajo Nation produced enough power to supply the needs of the state of New Mexico for 32 years on an annual basis, 85% of all Navajo households had no electricity. So I researched this, and I wrote it for some United Nations documents, the first UN Conference on the Rights of Indigenous People. I was asked to research for it, and I did. And then I was an undergraduate at Harvard at the time, and I was in my sophomore year, and I said, you know, I really don't want to research these communities anymore. I want to go live there and work for them. So I went down and worked at Navajo as a wee slip of a girl around 19. And that's when I realized that there wasn't a word for radiation in Navajo. What was happening is that Navajo uranium miners were being sent underground into uranium mine shafts in sacred places, and they were being exposed, and there was no word to describe what was going to happen to them. It was really a moment for me when I realized like the depth of the deceit. A lot of what I did as a young woman was trying to bring something out of obscurity, because a lot of times what happens on Indian reservations nobody knows about because nobody cares in the federal government, because you don't have political power or money. You're in a pack, but also because we're rural and remote and people of color and poor and statistics and a story that nobody really wants to remember. So I worked on organizing to oppose mines. Did a lot of community education outreach, pretty much been at every proposed mine or every mine that was on the reservation, and helped people defeat new uranium mines at Navajo. There hasn't been a new nuclear power plant built in this country for 30 years for good reason. You know, if you don't know what to do with the waste and you don't know what you're doing, and it's something that's so toxic that it lasts 100,000 years and kills you, probably shouldn't be messing with it. That's why the Creator put it in the ground. It's not supposed to be out in the atmosphere. It's supposed to be in the ground. I learned many lessons from the Navajo Dene people. But one was is that they had a teaching that they were given a choice between two yellow powders as people, as a Navajo people. And one yellow powder was corn pollen. And the other one was, they assumed to be yellow cake, what they call processed uranium. And if they chose one, they would have life. And if they chose another, things would not go so well. And the Navajo people chose corn pollen, but the United States chose uranium.
Today, the Navajo Nation and other indigenous peoples produce most of the world's uranium and other nuclear materials. And now, global capital is targeting Indian lands for new mining, in spite of the fact that uranium mining, milling, fuel fabrication, and enrichment contribute substantially to global warming and climate change. So Winona LaDuke has been called back to the anti-nuclear struggle.
So I spent my young years, early 20s, fighting uranium mining, and then I moved back to my own reservation and ended up fighting dam projects in northern Canada, because the reality is that you can fight the predator off in one place, but because the United States has the single largest, most inefficient energy economy in the world, we didn't change our demand, and we didn't even question our demand. We just made it worse. Here I am, 2012, looking at a new set of uranium mines, a new reboot of the nuclear industry, and still the same problems with nuclear waste and radiation exposure. Now, the politicians are thinking that nuclear power is the answer to climate change. And my thinking is, if that's the answer, I don't know what the question was. You know, if the question was, you want to make more concentrated power that's really expensive and lethal and end up in nuclear slavery for 10,000 years, how would you do that? Your answer is nuclear power. If you want nuclear weapons proliferation, your answer is nuclear power. If you want energy that it's going to supply this country and be just, be sustainable, and be secure, you want wind and solar. Because you can count on the wind and you can count on the sun. You can't count on nuclear power. So now there's a resurgence in the uranium industry, resurgence of uranium mining proposals around the Navajo Nation, although the Navajo Nation has a moratorium on uranium mining. Every Indian tribe in this country has a moratorium on uranium mining because we know that thousands of people, our people, died from exposure to radiation. but the nuclear industry is leasing land all surrounding our reservations, including the Grand Canyon, which I don't know what's so awesome about trying to put a uranium mine in the middle of the Grand Canyon. It seems like a national historic wonder of the world. Might not want to mine it, but that's the way they think, you know. So our communities are fighting it again, from Baker Lake up in Northwest Territories to Aboriginal Territories in Australia and to the Lakota in Nebraska, a place where Crazy Horse was assassinated, has a uranium mine there. We're fighting all that, as well as nuclear waste proposals that continue to emerge for Indian country, and a good chunk of the nuclear weapons in this country and contamination still remains on or adjacent to Indian reservations.
At the turn of the 20th century, a well-known Native American leader named Black Elk wrote of a vision he had of a great transformation in the world brought on by the crimes of human beings against the earth and driven by the wind. Winona LaDuke has her own perspective on Black Elk's prophecy about that wind.
A lot of our stories are wind as animate in most of our understandings and as a power to be reckoned with and respected. It turns out that Indian reservations, go figure, are the windiest place in the country. My reservation in western Minnesota has class 4 wind, which is about as good as you can get in Minnesota, but you got class 6 and 7 throughout the Dakotas. You have the best wind potential, the sweetest wind spot in North America's Indian communities, and around the world, indigenous communities have 75% of the world's best wind energy potential. That's the industry we need to move into. You know, it represents a different paradigm, and it represents a way to relate to the greatness of creation. Now, so I do believe that that is part of the prophecy that they're talking about, but I also think that part of the prophecy is that in a time of global climate destabilization, wind velocity and tornadoes, hurricanes increase dramatically. You've got really destructive winds that are going to occur in increasing numbers because of what we're doing to the environment and global climate destabilization. So you have, as in the story of the Navajo with the two powders, one yellow cornmeal, one yellow cake, we have the same with the wind. We have wind that is the power for the people, wind that brings you new air, clears your lungs, clears your land, and you got wind that's going to destroy. And both those are going to be here in every one of our communities, and that's what you got to look forward to. It's a question of how you relate to the power. It's always what it is.
Love, lift us up where we belong, where the eagles cry on a mountain high. Love, lift us up where we belong, far from the world we know, up where the clear winds blow.
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. Today's program is a special collaboration with the Women Rising Radio Series, a project of Crown Safira Productions. Visit us on the web at radioproject.org and at womenrisingradio.com.
Now the sun has come to earth, shrouded in a mushroom cloud of death comes in a blinding flash of hellish heat and leaves a smear of ash. And the sun has come to earth.
Alice Slater's children had grown up and moved out. She'd gone to law school and was working as a full-time litigator when the issue of nuclear weapons grabbed her and changed her life.
And I saw this thing in the Law Journal that they were having a luncheon for the Lawyers Alliance for Nuclear Arms Control. And I said, that sounds interesting. So I go down and I learn more about nuclear weapons than any sane person should ever have to know. There's 19,000 weapons on the planet and 18,000 are in the U.S. and Russia. So if the U.S. and Russia don't get down, nobody's going to really be serious about it. Obama was negotiating the START treaty with Medvedev, where they were cutting from like 8,000 to 2,500, and they're still on hair trigger alert, pointed at each other, ready to go off in minutes, pointed at Moscow and New York and Washington and St. Petersburg. It's insane. And in order to get this little START treaty through the Senate, which really didn't get rid of nuclear weapons, it just cut the numbers, Obama had to make this deal with the Republicans and some Democrats in the Senate for another $80 billion and $100 billion for submarines, airplanes, and missiles to carry the bombs around the world. This is insane. The Congress is bought. There's hundreds of millions of dollars corrupting their votes. You know, even here in New York, where we're supposed to be liberal, our senators vote for Lockheed Martin and all these big military contractors. They own the Congress. People get it, that we're all fighting the same enemy, corruption of democracy. And the reason we have nuclear weapons and we don't have clean air and clean water and we don't have solar and wind, and then they're inflicting nuclear power on us. Obama just gave $8.5 billion to Georgia to build two new nuclear power plants. We haven't built nuclear power since Three Mile Island. They've got everybody bought and on the run. You know, they've had this wacko theory for years, nuclear deterrence. And deterrence, T-E-R-R, it's terror. It's from the root word terror. It's like we'll terrorize you and you terrorize us, and then we'll be safe. But the real danger right now is like things going wrong. I mean, like these hair trigger alert missiles that we're pointing at Russia and they're pointing at us. About 10 years ago, Norway had a weather satellite that went off course, and the Russians were looking at it. It was the Soviets then, and thinking it was a U.S. missile. And the guy in their control room had orders to, like, fire his missiles back at us. And he disobeyed his orders. Otherwise, we might have had a nuclear war. But we're still clinging to this tattered doctrine. It doesn't make any sense at all.
The high point of Alice Slater's work in nuclear disarmament was the creation of Abolition 2000, a worldwide campaign to ban the nuclear bomb and all nuclear production. Alice is at the forefront of this campaign, mobilizing a global network of anti-nuclear activists.
This is my baby. I love it. We came together in 1995 because the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which was signed in 1970, was only supposed to last for 25 years, and then they were supposed to come together and see how they were doing. And the bargain was that five nuclear powers, the U.S., Russia, England, France, and China, promised to give up their weapons if the whole rest of the world promised not to get them. That was the treaty. And everybody signed except India, Pakistan, Israel, and they got their own bombs. They didn't make the promise. Now it's 1995. There are three times as many bombs on the planet as when they promised to get rid of them. And there were about 100 NGOs that showed up at the UN from all over the world in New York. And we saw that they weren't serious about it. The U.S. was twisting arms and lobbying to get the treaty extended indefinitely without conditions, just keep it in place. And that's when we drafted our abolition statement calling for a treaty to eliminate nuclear weapons and for the establishment of an international renewable energy agency to phase out nuclear power, particularly focusing on poor countries to harness the sun, the wind. There's a lot of people working all over the world, lobbying governments in our network. We're now in 95 countries. We have over 2,000 organizations, and we're trying to get a negotiation started to ban the bomb. And the U.S. is saying no. And then Russia and China start to rearm, and these same guys that are driving this arms race go to the American people and say, oh, we need even more missiles, more defense, because look at Russia, look at China. And Russia and China for the last 5 years have been tabling a treaty in the UN Commission on Disarmament in Geneva to keep weapons out of space. And every country in the world votes for it except us, and we block it. And then we say we have to fight them in space. This is insane.
While working on Abolition 2000, Alice has also developed the Bronx Project, focusing on cleaning up nuclear waste and closing nuclear power plants.
Well, I always joke about the Bronx Project, that we had the Manhattan Project to build the bomb, and we need the Bronx Project to clean it up. It's not just the bomb, it's Fukushima, it's nuclear power, it's the uranium mining. You can't really clean up nuclear waste. It lasts for 250,000 years. It's poisonous. How can we even think that we'd make one more drop of it? And that's what these nuclear reactors are churning it out all the time, aside from the bomb. We should stop making more. We should keep it where it is. This is the Bronx Project. When you think about Indian Point nuclear power plant, 25 miles up the Hudson River from New York City, 22 million people in the evacuation zone. I mean, you can't even get to the beach on Friday night. There's so much traffic. There's no way to get away from it. And it was really interesting. The New York Times reported after 9/11 that Al-Qaeda was looking at Indian Point as a possible target. So I always said we were lucky they hit the World Trade Center. I mean, if they hit Indian Point, New York would have been a sacrifice zone like Fukushima. We wouldn't have been able to live here anymore. And where would all the people go? We've just been going to our city council to try to get a resolution to shut down Indian Point. Not that we have the power. It sits in Washington, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. It's like we're living in the Soviet Union. We don't have any power. Even our governor wants to close it. He can't close it. I mean, it's going to take an act of Congress to make the thing happen, or I don't know, we have to buy off the company so they'll go away and leave us alone.
Since the Fukushima nuclear disaster, there is a renewed global effort to get rid of nuclear weapons and nuclear energy. The brightest light in this paradigm shift is Germany, where the parliament recently voted overwhelmingly to shut the country's 17 nuclear power plants by 2022, replacing them with renewable energy. And the German-based corporation Siemens, a giant in nuclear industries and Europe's largest engineering company, announced it will stop building nuclear power plants altogether. There are signs of a revitalized grassroots anti-nuclear movement in the United States, with protests at the Vermont Yankee plant and across the country at Diablo Canyon in California. In 2012, two reactors at the San Onofre power plant in California went offline because thousands of transit tubes were rotting near to bursting. Protesters crowded Nuclear Regulatory Commission meetings demanding that the plant be shut down for good. That's it for this Women's Desk edition of Making Contact, co-produced with Lynn Feinerman's Women Rising radio series, a project of Crown Safira Productions. Learn more about the work of these courageous women at womenrisingradio.com and at radioproject.org. Music courtesy of the Ian Campbell Trio, Alicia Keys, Kraftwerk, Nihon 311, and Buffy St. Marie. Thanks to the staff and volunteers of the National Radio Project. I'm your host, Sandina Robbins. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.